Welcome to the Building Science Podcast.
Bringing the human factor to architecture and design.
Brought to you by Positive Energy in Austin, Texas.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the Building Science Podcast. I'm Christoph Irwin. Today, I'm here with Dr. Liz McCormick. Super excited to get into this interview. Today, we're going to be talking about her new book, which she edited and wrote several pieces of. It's called Inside Out, Human Health and the Air Conditioning Era. And those of you who know me, have been here before, you know that I couldn't resist this topic. So a few introductory comments, just a few, Liz, and then I'll bring Liz in. So air conditioning, the word conditioning is actually meaningful, right? This is one of those things where we use a term so much that we don't think about it. But technically speaking, we condition materials for our benefit. So think of a hair conditioner, right? You condition your hair. We would condition wood to be used in furniture, or you could condition leather to be used in clothing or shoes, right? Air conditioning is not mere cooling. And in fact, when it first came out, I've seen pictures of, instead of air conditioning, they call it refrigerated air, which is more exact, more correct. So air conditioning implies that the properties of air, the air we breathe, support positive impact on human occupancy. And that's what this book is about. This is all part of a larger kind of context of the whole indoor environment. IAQ, indoor air quality, is part of IEQ, indoor environmental quality. And so the other influences are sound, light, vibration, odor, chemical, electromagnetic, you know, EMF exposures, and the indoor microbiome. So that all forms this, quote, condition, this indoor condition that will either, you know, add up to a net positive for our comfort, our health and well-being, or not. And that was actually stolen from a quote from the book. So the book quote from Liz is, "The indoor condition exists in an interdependent web of circumstances that stretch well beyond its immediate disciplinary boundaries. The human relationship with indoor space is complex and cannot be studied through a single method or single disciplinary lens." So cool. Go, Liz. And one last quote from her, and then we'll introduce her. So in response to that, that you can't just look at it from one lens, right? In response, this book brings together architects, anthropologists, and ecologists to discuss the state of the interior space in the air conditioning era. Okay, with those introductory remarks, Liz, welcome to the show. So glad you're here. And I didn't do your bio. Would you mind instead just introducing yourself?
I'd be happy to. So I'm a assistant professor at UNC Charlotte in North Carolina. My background's in architecture and building technology. I made the move into academia after many years in practice. So I worked at SU Dumas Ripple in New Orleans, HOK in Houston. And there was a point where I wasn't doing the type of work I wanted to be doing. And then I went back to school and then started working in teaching.
Love it. So you didn't start in the quote unquote ivory tower.
No, definitely not.
Mm-hmm. So you know the boots on the ground perspective. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So what do you teach at UNC Charlotte? Or is it UNC? Where is it? I can look in your book.
UNC Charlotte, yes.
Yeah, I said it right. Okay.
Which there's no UNC is the main campus. You know, if you think of UNC basketball, it's in Chapel Hill, but we are the only UNC with a architecture school. So I'm in the School of Architecture and I teach in the building technology curriculum, but you know, I went to RISD, my background's in design. So I'm very much a designer. I teach early level design studios, but also kind of the more advanced technology electives.
Really cool. So RISD, what's that?
RISD, Rhode Island School of Design.
All right. Okay. Yeah, I've heard of that. Excellent. So teaching technology to architects.
Yep.
Was woven in there. How's that going?
We talked about this last time. It's really, I'm not old enough to say these kids, you know, in any sort of way, but I think students today like to have advanced simulation tools and, you know, colorful graphics and really flashy designs and that sort of thing. I really like to focus on just the basic physics and kind of hiding building science and just everyday conversations about design. So you really can't talk about design without talking about the way the sun moves, or, you know, the earth moves around the sun, or how air moves, that sort of thing. So it's very much about sneaking in building science so that they understand basic principles. And then later in their career, they can start applying these more high-tech systems, but just very much focused on the basics.
Yeah, that is so, so important. It's in some sense, so I'm actually remembering we interviewed Bill Bram here on searching for the bioclimatic law. And it really comes out of a deep human sympathetic understanding of buildings and the environment and the climate. And yeah, if we pass along that sympathetic understanding to software systems and we don't have it, like, who works for who, right? We're really, and that's not to berate software, because in the hands of someone that's very skilled, you can really dial it down. And, you know, we've done many years of architectural simulations, and it really is impactful in the sense that if you can do graphical overlay on the architectural plan of thermal comfort, for instance, it really speaks, you know, or just highlight, you know, energy flowing through windows and color code that from red to green. It really makes a difference. Okay.
The bane of my existence is when I have a student, you know, we're talking about just early design and what if you rotate it 90 degrees on the site? What's that going to do for you? And they say, oh, okay, well, let me run it through the simulation tool. And I say, no. You know, basically, if you orient a building east-west versus north-south, what's that going to do? There are basic principles to know. You don't have to know what the EUI is. It's like you can, there's simple things you can understand without running it through a tool.
Yeah, you don't need to abdicate all decision-making to the Borg or whatever. You're also about to head to Tanzania.
Yes.
Where you have a pretty cool project with some Tanzania brickwork. So I challenge you to try to encapsulate what you're doing there, because it does have some building science and some real world applicability, but it's not really the point of our show. But please go for it.
So I'm the architect on the team. The team is really run by a social scientist, and we have entomologists, and they're social scientists and anthropologists. And what we're trying to do is create housing that makes life better in rural communities in Tanzania. So what that means is we're not raising the cost. We're not having advanced systems. We're not doing things that people can't do on their own. And so what we're looking at is actually just modifying what we call the humble brick, the most accessible building material on the planet. And if you have really simple modifications to it, you can dramatically influence the interior environment of the home. And part of the reason we're working with entomologists is that when you break down a wall so you have it more open in certain regions with, you know, in malaria endemic regions, you're opening it up to risks. And so we're not just introducing cooling air into the wall, we're actually trying to trap mosquitoes, deter mosquitoes, and again, with just simple geometry and simple manipulations. So funny little story, I was at the gym this morning, and it's an unair-conditioned kind of warehouse building. And someone was working on this area, and she said, when I'm here in this area, this is where I get mosquito bites, because it's like the air is trapped. And I said, yes, that's exactly right. That's how convection works, because you have these, you know, airflow, you have an inlet and outlet, and then it creates this little convective pocket and it traps mosquitoes there. And so it's the same idea of what we're trying to harness at a smaller scale, is that if we're moving airflow through and you create a little, you know, current for mosquitoes to land, then you're passing conditioned air through, but trapping the mosquitoes. So it's just thinking about all of these really advanced things with, it's just convection.
Wow. That's really cool. Yeah. You're creating like conditions that the mosquitoes can't easily just move to a new location because of air currents. It's like being in a river current and you can't swim out or something.
Right.
That's fascinating. That is fascinating. And I love the interdisciplinary aspect of it. I mean, the building sciences started out as thermodynamics and fluid mechanics and it was enclosure systems and climate systems. And then I think begrudgingly, we started to add, you know, mechanical plumbing, electrical systems, and then human systems. And now, yeah, absolutely. We're at the place where we need to really, how do we get past no, K-N-O-W, to do?
Yeah.
And that's where the social scientists will come in. So you have bricks with holes in them. Like, how big are the holes? Can you describe that?
It depends. We're, you know, still working through that. A lot of the modules that we've been working with have been standard US size bricks. So, mm-hmm. you know, very small, maybe 1-inch diameter max. But they're, I wouldn't say they're holes. Some of the prototypes have holes, but more of them are kind of a channel so that it passes the entire width of the brick through the wall.
Okay.
And some of it comes with like how they're stacked and how that creates little pockets of air and that sort of thing.
Fascinating. That sounds really cool. And I'm already feeling questions coming, but can we link to something for that?
Sure.
So the book, Inside Out, Human Health and the Air Conditioning Era. Thank you for writing it. I love it. Mine is dog-eared. It's well-traveled. It's, I don't know how if you are about sacred books and writing in them, but I've
written it. No, I love to see it.
Read all over it. How did you come to want to do this and assemble? Tell us a little more about the origin story of the book, and then we'll do the contents.
So it came, this was really the literature review section of my dissertation work. I started my PhD in the spring of 2020. So things just started falling apart, and it was a virtual program. And it was at the point where I was picking my topic. So during that time, talking about COVID and respiratory health and all that sort of thing, all I could think about was our relationship with buildings, and, you know, not so much about just increasing ventilation and that sort of things, but our relationship with buildings is really flawed. And that, you know, when we moved outside, we not only improved respiratory health, we created all of these other, thinking back to Adele's podcast, co-benefits, you know, sensory engagement and just like delight with being under a shaded tree and those sorts of things. So it was really honestly going through and picking a topic during COVID. And at that point, I started doing all this research about systems because, you know, I went to school for building technology. It's about optimizing. It's about systems and that sort of thing. But then there was just so much history of why we were doing things the way we are. And we have the technology to do the stuff we need to do. But it's about changing minds, changing, understanding the context of, you know, kind of this world that we're in. And that's, it turned into a symposium. So we hosted this event in Charlotte. Sarah Haynes, Marcel Harmon, Z. Smith, and Sean Vance came and gave a presentation. And then we had this really awesome discussion about just, you know, being outdoors while indoors and the relationship with space. And funny enough, I didn't want to do the symposium in our typical theater that we have on campus. It had to be an indoor-outdoor space. And so on the day of this event, it absolutely stormed. It could not have been more dramatic. It was like flooding and just like lightning and thunder and everything. And so we were doing it at a brewery and they had this kind of pavilion. And it was so perfect because we were able to roll down these, you know, walls. And then when it became nice at the end of the symposium, the conversations, we're all drinking beers and talking, it just spilled out into the lawn next to it because we had rolled those walls up. And it was amazing.
Yeah, that's so cool. What a cool coincidence.
At the time, it felt like, you know, the world was ending. This event I had planned was, you know, nobody could get to, but
right. Things work out. Yeah, that's great. And what a list. We've had several of them, or at least Z has been on the show before. I look forward to having Sarah and the others. I really look forward to that. Yeah. And, you know, it came up earlier, and it's another quote from your book now, tying it in. You wrote, by studying the close associations between sociocultural constructs, so that's where I want to go, and technological development, Inside Out serves to contextualize modern strategies of indoor space within the broader view of global sustainability and human health, right? That's so cool. You know, actually, we didn't plan this, but it's sort of like what we talked about with doing a simulation versus having some more holistic understanding. I think one of the things that we don't understand is this socio, or not don't understand. We don't realize that, hey, listeners, I don't know if you know this, but both Liz and I and you all listening, we have sociocultural constructs installed in our personalities and in our brains right now, and they influence everything we think we know and, you know, the decisions. Tell us about that, Liz. Because you're a psychologist, of course.
Oh, of course, yes. That, I mean, it's all things I've learned about myself doing the doctoral program. When I went into it thinking a fact is a fact and what we know is truth. But so much of what we know is constructed based on your context, and that knowledge may mean something different to someone in a different context. So, you know, when you're talking about health and a lot of the things we think about with like healthy buildings and that sort of thing, spitting, sneezing, those were not associated with health. They were more associated with etiquette, mm-hmm. you know, back in the 1500s and that sort of thing. And it wasn't until the germ theory evolved in the late 1800s that we associated those things with poor health. And that was the sanitation movement and that sort of thing came about. And so the way that we design our buildings now is so much based on what we perceive to be healthy. And that also comes from like antibiotics, the antibiotic mindset of you just come in and you knock out all of the bacteria, but a lot of the bacteria is good. So I think, you know, as science is evolving, we're learning more about probiotic health and that sort of thing. I've kind of gone adrift here, but you know, there's so much that's influencing the way we inhabit space and the way we design and build buildings that, you know, if we understand that first before we start to change the technology, I think the technology will change in a more meaningful way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If the paradigms, if our worldviews are as close to accurate as possible, then what we do with our intelligence, yeah, again, it's like that simulation. What we do with our intelligence is amplified. So you actually talked about the footprint of the indoor environment, the indoor space. And I really hadn't thought about that. You know, I know for a lot of us that the idea of carbon footprint is on our minds. And I think we know that at least we're told the sociocultural construct is that one of the oil companies said, hey, let's deflect people looking at us for carbon footprint. And let's say it's you all, hey, yeah. Your personal carbon footprint is the problem, right? And it's not the large polluter somewhere. But so the footprint of the indoor environment, you were saying, has these dimensions like physical footprint, the psychological footprint we just touched on a little, and the ecological. So what is the, could you describe a little bit about the physical footprint or put that in context for us?
I mean, take Manhattan, for example. This is not your typical American city, but in Manhattan, there's more interior space than there is land area. And that is shifting in dense cities around the world. The amount of land area we have on the planet is similar to grasslands or other ecosystems, and that there are species that exist only within interior space.
Whoa.
They have evolved based on these new ecosystems that we've created. So this is not this, you know, side thing that we think about. If we're talking about protecting the Amazon or like our wetlands or that sort of thing, interior space is on that level as well.
On that scale. Wow. Yeah. It's funny when you said there are certain species that exist mainly in interior spaces. I was thinking us.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. I don't think anyone would. I think the sociocultural construct is aligned with reality in the sense of many causes of ill health or lack of well-being are environmentally triggered.
Yeah.
You know, simple. No one's going to say, oh, what do you mean the environment? You know, like, no, there's environmental pollutants, and pollutant implies negative outcomes for something in that ecosystem. So if it's formaldehyde or tobacco smoke or VOCs, PFAS.
We don't think about that, you know, our interior pollutants as bad as exterior pollutants, because we don't see them. We don't necessarily smell them. We don't see smoke billowing from stacks or anything like that, or car exhaust or anything. But inside is it, I read this somewhere, it's not my quote, but it's indoor air is the invisible enemy of our generation. And we don't realize how bad, I don't want to fearmonger or anything, but just how toxic these spaces can be. And we just think of, when we're talking about air pollution, we're thinking about being in a busy intersection. But even the EPA, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency, says that indoor air can be 2 to 5 times worse than outdoor air. Mm-hmm. During construction, when the paint is new, when you have dust in the air, it can be 100 times worse.
Yeah. 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 I love it. Just a visual of someone's, you know, bedroom in Times Square in Manhattan with all the cars going by. And yeah, I actually want to I don't want to detour us. I know where we're going to go.
We're on track.
But this thing that you just said about, I don't want to fearmonger. So you and I both talk to a lot of people about air quality. I know I do. And I talk to a lot of architects and builders and owners. And, you know, I know a fair amount, and I know enough to go, holy moly, there's not nothing here.
Yeah.
And yet I also know, like, psychologically, that at some point, if I go down this litany of potential ills, someone's brain, like many of the listeners' brain, just said, oh, good grief, this guy's bonkers, I can't go there. Any personal thoughts about how to talk about indoor air quality to others, or how do you relate to it? Yeah.
I mean, this came up a lot right after my book came out, where I started getting a lot of calls and inquiries from different, you know, magazines or newspapers, and they wanted to know what products they should buy for their home, whether it's an air filter or a spray, a disinfecting, whatever. And I was like, did you guys even read the book? I mean, the whole thing is not about adding more technology to something that we've created. I think there's a lot of opportunity in just opening a window, you know, feeling a simple breeze. That doesn't mean you're having to add more stuff and make the home more pure. You know, we think of buildings as sanctuaries, and then we can kind of out technology our way out of different situations. But just if we step back a little bit and, you know, just like I said, open a window, that introduces so many good things, and it improves the mood, introduces good bacteria, you know, releases some of the indoor air. So I think there has to be at a certain extent of proving how, again, I don't want to say toxic, but like how, what is in the indoor air, just making people aware of that so that we can start to have those conversations. Because otherwise it's kind of like, well, why would I open the window? There are mosquitoes, there are, it's like pollen, all of these types of things.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of goes back to the paradigms or the sociocultural constructs, this idea that technology will save us.
Right.
Which, you know, sort of rides on top of nature will always provide for humanity's needs endlessly forever. But this idea that technology will save us, and the idea of additive indoor air technology, right? Like, oh, you know, your air would be better if you had ions in it, or yeah. You know, this plasma were in it, or when really it's pretty simple. All your body is expecting, you know, given that there's really just mild filtration on the way into your blood, your body is saying very clearly that it expects clean air to be around you. Otherwise, yeah. It would have like your digestive system where it says, this is good air, this is waste air. It could be like an exit hole for waste air, but there isn't, right? So the body is saying, I expect clean air. And so we know what clean air is. It's air with pollutants, things that are not good for us added. We're going to get into this actually. Yeah. So it's pretty simple, but it's also, technology will save us really informs a lot of people's like deep inner yearnings for how to make air better. It's like, you know how we make air better is sell me something. Oh, wait, now we have capitalism, materialism. Covetousness.
Well, and with all the emerging evidence that's coming out about gas stoves and allergies for children and that sort of thing, that becomes an energy conversation. Whereas I'm not trying to force any sort of liberal agenda, you know, save the planet, that sort of thing. I'm just saying, like, if you didn't have combustion in your home, maybe your kid wouldn't be sick all the time. But then you're stepping on people's way of life, because gas stoves are so much associated with luxury and status and class and all these sorts of things, that it's hard to isolate, you know, the the benefits that you get from something versus the harm.
Yeah. Hear, hear. And not just that, but we'll get into the air quality. Yeah, listeners, we're going toward air quality and we're going to talk about it, you know, why it matters and how to make it good. But this, see, we're in this interesting spot here thinking about paradigms, like, because there's that marketing slogan, cooking with gas.
Yes.
Cooking with gas. Right. And, it really worked. And, you know, for the last 100 years, very well funded, hundreds of millions of dollars of public relation campaigns have been aimed at all of us saying, oh, thank goodness for the fossil fuels, right? And there's validity to it, and it can go too far. But I'm totally with you. Like, as a consultant for clients, you know, the energy play for gas, you know, the conserving energy or conserving, you know, the clean air in the atmosphere that we have left, is like, that's for heating the home or heating the water, right? You electrify those for energy, actually also for efficiency. But the stove, that goes away for your health, right? Yeah. You don't have to, that's not an energy play. It's like, I've seen numbers, it's between like 0.5% and 1.5% of the energy used in a home is actually the gas combusted for cooking. But then you have these nitrous oxides and the particles and, you know, carbon monoxide, odorless. Yeah, okay, one more last thing. Odorless, colorless, indetectable by us. It's like our human bodies are not ready, or minds are not ready to deal with invisible things.
Well, but it's not as invisible, I think, as you might think, because new car smell, everybody loves new car smell. That's just VOCs, you know, but we associate it with something positive. When you have fresh paint, everybody's like, oh, everything's clean and healthy in here. No, that's VOCs.
Right.
So
right.
We really can detect it. We're just associating it with something else.
Yeah, that's a good point. It has become socioculturally normalized and almost even, quote, worse as good.
Yeah.
That pollutant that's causing you unhealth.
Fresh, you know, bleach clean, that sort of thing. It's like, are you doing more good than harm?
Yeah. Scented trash bags. So you mentioned this, the psychological dimension of the indoor environment, you know, this sort of like seeking hygiene or purity or cleanliness. Can you talk a little about that?
So I talk about this in one of the chapters in the book, but the idea of weatherlessness and what air conditioning brought us, you know, what it was first called was manufactured weather.
And that,
so inside you're creating your own weather. And you see, I have all these like historic or archival marketing campaigns about train schedules. We'll always be on time because we make our own weather, or, you know, you create your own weather indoors and that sort of thing. But what that created was that everything was consistent all the time. Everything, 72 degrees, 50% relative humidity all year round. You're not reacting to the seasons. You don't see the sunset, those sorts of things. And it creates this like psychological weatherlessness where you're not, this from this book, a moodless mood is what they called it. And it's kind of associated with modernism, is that maybe people are not as, you know, the extremes of the human condition is much narrower because we're not testing the extremes in a physical environment anymore, because everything is just so constant. So there are a lot of people who are advocating for more heterogeneous spaces, whereas our built environment is very homogenous. We go in, it's the same all the time. But if you add more spatial diversity, and that's even a criteria of well, to have different temperatures throughout the space, that is good for the brain. The brain needs stimulation. It helps the body function to have extreme conditions.
Yeah. It's so important. I mean, as an engineer, I feel a bit zinged, right? Like it's as though to do my job in a way that, you know, my clients are happy, and frankly, that my like attorney is happy, I need to be able to at least get you the thermal blandness that you want. Right? What temperature do you want throughout the house, please?
And that's the thing that's wild to me, is that we didn't do that for human good. We did that for machines, and so that the machines could be consistent and provide what we needed for humans. So what we're doing is designing for machines that are then providing space for humans. We're not designing for humans at all. So if we flip that and actually design for humans, I think it's going to change that mentality.
Got me nodding. Yeah. I mean, MERV 8 filters on mechanical systems. That's to prevent the heat exchanger from getting contaminated, getting fouled. Yeah. And so thermal exchange won't happen. If it was humans, it would be MERV 13 minimum, you know, MERV 16 higher. My wife and I are building a passive house in the Pacific Northwest, and we're doing radiant heating and cooling and an ERV. You know, very simple. Like, I won't diverge us, but you know, this whole thing about I need the air to be at the right temperature to be thermally comfortable. I mean, that's one of the things we want to showcase on this project. Like, no, that's untrue. And I'm thinking of Gail Brager. I'd love to get her on here. But I'm looking at your book right now. I made the mistake of flipping through while we're interviewing. And on the socially constructed microbiome chapter, you have some, like, you have, it's an ill wind that blows through open windows, and it's got this burglar climbing in, and then H.G. Wells, from Things to Come, it's like a city in a dome, and the aerologist from 1929, the fresh air of a fan. And there is this very clear, down with windows, up with profits. What's up with that? I don't understand that one. But there's this very clear vilification of the outdoor air, right? And up with profits. Does this down with windows, up with profits mean close your windows and buy our air conditioning system so we can have more profit?
It's closed. It was for a textile mill so that they were, you close the windows and that the machine can operate more smoothly.
Oh, so the ill wind again wasn't about ill wind quote, like the outdoor condition coming in through the window was about being negative for the productivity.
It was for the machines.
Oh my goodness. So we closed the windows on the outside world and said, heck yeah, that's a good thing. The mammal in us doesn't need to live outdoors anymore.
Right.
Wow. All right. So, yeah, I think this is good. So there's a certain thermal blandness, this placelessness, this sort of separating ourselves from nature in an effort to protect ourselves. But really, that's been, you know, an unskillful decision, unskillful action. And so the third, basically, you went through these three aspects of the footprint of the indoor environment. We've talked about physically and psychologically, and the last one is ecologically. Mm-hmm. And so this gets into the relationship with man and nature altogether, you know, this footprint of the indoor environment. Yeah, you're nodding. Got some thoughts on that?
Well, I'm trying to be, I wanted to look something up on my computer, but I didn't want you to hear all the mouse clicks.
Oh, go for it.
There's an author, she wrote a paper and I've met her, so I'm embarrassed I don't remember her name, but it's not that buildings don't use energy, people use energy.
Yeah.
And that we're always talking about the energy consumption of buildings, but as you know, as someone who works in the residential world, you cannot predict the behavior of the occupant in really any condition.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's just such a high footprint associated with that. That's so unpredictable.
You have this great quote in the book. It says, when we try to control nature, we often come to imagine ourselves outside nature, as if we were a species alone, disconnected from the rest of life and subject to different rules. This is a mistake. And you bold-faced that. That's from Rob Dunn, A Natural History of the Future. He also wrote a book on the indoor microbiome, which was tremendous. Yeah. I read that, yeah.
That's how I found his work, actually.
Ah, okay, of course. But this whole idea, like, and this gets deep, and this almost moves toward, like, wisdom traditions or religions, but this idea that it's almost like our direct experience is that humans have unique capacities, you know, for thinking and reason and tool-making, and gives us this power. And that makes us feel separate and superior, right? Mm-hmm. From and to the natural world. But this idea that nature isn't a living system, nature isn't an ecosystem with its own sort of intrinsic value, but really it's this passive backdrop for us. It's like Costco. We can go in and get, you know, or it's just a collection of resources waiting to be used by humans, right?
Resources, you know, even that word is problematic.
Yeah. Tell me.
Yeah, I mean, so what is it called when you have a deer head hung up on the wall? I don't imagine you're a hunter, but do you know what that is called?
It's a trophy something?
It's a trophy.
Yeah.
Which it's such a, like, it's our prize as these like big burly men to take down this amazing animal, that sort of thing. And it's, nature is a resource. It's something that was put here for us to, I don't want to say manipulate, but to, for us to control and that sort of thing. And if mm-hmm. you think of even like the Brundtland definition of what sustainability is, it's, I don't remember it exactly, but preserving our resources for the sake of future generations.
Right.
That says nothing about the planet. That only talks about humans. And I will say that we all know this. Humans are not going to be on this planet for very long. I'm not saying there's this like apocalypse coming. I'm just saying that's how it works with different species. They're not just here for the length of the planet. This planet will outsurvive us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to acknowledge that we're doing all of this for the sake of humans, making our planet better for humans, not for the planet sometimes.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most important statements that's been said on this podcast. Thank you for that. Yeah, but really, like, there is this idea you have sinned against the earth and now you have to pay penance by giving up your stove. And that is just so crazy. It's like, we want better and yeah. better is possible. Let's do better.
So there's an environmental philosopher who I really like, Freya Matthews, and she describes two theories or principles that separate humans from, you know, from nature, or how we've separated ourselves. And one of them is the principle of connectivity, which means that we sometimes make decisions that are not in the best interest of our evolutionary pathway, and that most organisms don't do that because they're all just trying to reproduce, trying to survive, that sort of thing. But humans are able to make conscious decisions that are not in our best interest.
Wow. So that's the principle of connectivity?
Connectivity.
Connectivity. I apologize. I don't know that word.
It's, well, either does my spell checker.
Ah. So what do you think it means, putting you on the spot? Oh, no. Note. Like something could connote something. Like connote.
Oh, yeah, that makes meaning. Sense. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it reminded me of, I guess it's an allegory about the young man comes home to his village and he has just gone off to the city to be educated. And he comes back and he sees the village elder sitting by the well, lowering a rope down into the well and bringing up a bucket. And he says, "Ha ha, old man, let me fashion a winch for you so you can do this with less energy, less effort." So he does that. And then he shows the village elder and says, "What do you think, dude?" And the village elder says, "Let me reflect on this. Come ask me in the morning." So the morning he goes back to the village elder and the village elder says, "You know, I do not like this invention of yours." And the young man's like, "What? Are you kidding? This is technology and it makes your life better." And he says, "Well, if I do like this invention, but if I go this direction, I will become infatuated with my cunning mind and lost in thought. And when I arrive at such a state, how will the water taste?" Mm. Right? So there's really depth there. This idea that, you know, you prompted that with, like, we make decisions that actually aren't in our evolutionary interest. And there's this evolutionary interest. And then there's this interest in, like, the quality of our life. It could be rich and meaningful and multifaceted and full of, like, as you said, sunlight and breezes and even mild discomfort for a minute. Guess what's great about discomfort? Later you get comfort and you're like, yay. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that you could tell this like lights me up, this whole podcast on how did we end up thinking we're separate from nature? It's time to rethink our built environments, and outdated ideas are powerful and sticky, and we need to try to change them. So once again, we're talking about your book, Inside Out, Human Health and the Air Conditioning Era. So we've talked about that doesn't just mean air cooling. And we're getting into the kind of the core aspect of this interview, which is indoor air quality. This is our way of saying human health when you live immersed in a body of air that you made and you had control of. So first thing, I think, without getting too much into it, and it almost seems flippant, but Why does indoor air quality matter, Liz?
I mean, it's the air we breathe. It's the same reason that we talk about outdoor air quality. Breathing is the one thing that every single human on the planet does. And this is something that John Vance wrote about in his chapter. It's really something that unites us and brings us all together. And when we think a lot about health and that sort of thing, you're often not thinking about respiratory health, unless we're talking about, you know, being in the room with somebody with the flu or a cold or something like that. And it came up a lot during COVID. But the things that are released from, you mentioned, formaldehyde or cleaning products, VOCs, paints. I just did a year-long study in four different office buildings belonging to one architecture firm. And I was tracking their VOC every 15 minutes of the day. During lunch, when they were heating up their lunch, there'd be a huge spike in VOCs. And it would dissipate quickly, so it wasn't a huge risk. But sometimes if someone would come in with a lot of cologne, that would have a high VOC the whole day, cleaning, laundry detergents, that sort of thing. And even just our behavior, how much we're respirating in a space, has a dramatic influence on someone. It could be in the same building, but three floors up, that sort of thing. And air is just something that we all share.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. Just to expand on it. But like, I go into a lot of homes to do building science consulting, and this gets back to the IEQ side of things. And you walk into the house and the first thing is like, yeah, it smells like all kinds of different things. The scented trash bags and the laundry detergent and then the plug-in VOC emitter that's, you know, sold on purpose. But it's not just that, because then there's other thing is like these really bright, like bluish lights are on everywhere. And then there's TVs on in every room, and sometimes they're on different channels. So it's just like, in terms of the indoor environment, like I come in and I can almost feel like dysregulated. Like, yeah. Could you turn the lights off, get this windows open, get the smell out, and turn the TVs off so that I can just be here and observe what's in this space, right? So I don't say that.
Sure.
But like that's sort of beyond like the reason that I'm there as a consultant, but it's not really beyond the well-being that they want. Okay, so we're getting into sort of a comprehensive model for indoor air quality and human health. This is something we talked about when we were setting this up. And so this model considers the interactions of basically three things, right? There's pollutants, pathways, and then exposures after pollutants and pathways. And maybe we will just mainly focus on pollutants and pathways because the exposures kind of comes natural. So do you have any thoughts about pollutants in indoor environments?
You know, the thing I've learned working with commercial buildings is they're not as interested in source control, certainly, as they should be. Mm-hmm. And that when you're talking about air quality, they're always going back to increasing ventilation, having more filters. It's again leaning back to technology, and not that our behavior, my behavior, your behavior, that's impacting the air just as much as the MERV 13 filters or whatever you go with. So
yeah,
having low VOC is good, low VOC carpets, all those sorts of things. But honestly, just tracking, understanding what is this environment you've created. If you're really sleepy one day, what does that link to on CO2? And maybe that's your personal threshold of you know, where you should be functioning. And just understanding those conditions, because as designers and engineers, we make all of these environments and we make these really large claims, but understanding the metrics is hugely important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just thinking about like, let's say I was sleepy. Would I suspect, you know, VOC emissions? Would I even stop and say, oh, I just didn't sleep well last night?
Yeah.
Would I even start to think, why am I not sleeping deeply? You know, which absolutely can be impacted by CO2 or particulates or VOCs. And even, I apologize, for some reason, I'm just very meta today. Even if I was sleepy, what I'd probably do is be like, let me have some coffee or, yep, you know, some soda. So I need some caffeine. That's what I need, right? I need this other molecule that now jams on my adrenal system, makes my body think I'm being chased by a tiger in response. So it's like, we compound the issues, right?
Well, so as I was tracking these spaces, and even when I was working at SQ in New Orleans, constantly tracking CO2, CO2 levels peak in office spaces sometime after lunch and around 3 o'clock. That's when most people, for me, I want a cookie.
Yeah.
Most people want coffee or something, some sort of pick me up. That's also when CO2 is the highest. So, you know, if you were to mitigate that a little bit, maybe you wouldn't have these other things, but we never associate it with air pollutants. It's just, that's a 3 o'clock slump.
Right. Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. So the sources side gets really rich, right? As you say, there's us, right?
Yep.
If you take us out of an indoor environment, like if you were doing like gas chromatography and had the spectrum of an indoor environment, oh my gosh, it would be so simple to know, like when the students came into a classroom or when the workers came into an office. But that's also kind of, I mean, I guess not irrelevant, but it's sort of like, well, so you know, you're not,
yeah, if
you're making a space healthy for me, I need to be in it.
Right.
But yeah, so these body odors and bioeffluents, like things coming off of us. I'm tempted right now to launch into the indoor microbiome. Okay, so there's us, and then there's all kinds of other living beings in and on us, but we've talked about this, and we're going to save this for Sarah Haynes, but, you know, in the air, there's viruses and bacteria and the dreaded fungi I just mentioned, and pollen, pet dander, dust mites. There's all these living creatures, and we mentioned cleaning products, sources of VOCs, and you mentioned cooking. Can you, I don't want to put you on the spot too much here, but what comes up, what's the matter with cooking?
I don't know that. I think it's just heat being applied to anything. When you get some sort of smell, it's going to come with some sort of off-gassing.
Mm-hmm. And so you say it's delicious. And I guess it's delicious to eat, but you don't have to coat the inside of your lungs with it as much as we do. Maybe you can.
Right. It's not to say that cooking, you know, when we're talking about gas stoves, the food is not the problem. It's the combustion of the fuel. That's more the problem. But you know, when you talk, and I want you to talk to Sarah about this, but the Human Microbiome Project from early 2000s is really like, this is a new thing. We're starting to understand how much bacteria, how much life lives on the body. That is it human? Is it not human? I mean, any of my students from last semester will roll their eyes when I ask that. But 2 to 4 pounds of our body is bacteria. And this bacteria is essential to our gut function, our brain function, all of these different things, where I would not be the person I am without all of this bacteria that's on my body. So is this part of me, or am I part of the ecosystem? So it's kind of, it leads you to these ontological questions about what does it mean to be human? Because what these scientists say is that we're not an individual as we once thought we were. We're both individual and a community. We're part of a community and a community within ourselves, which I think is really fascinating, because buildings, we think of so much as individual isolated elements, but there's so much life that occurs in these spaces. And that's a lot of the work that Rob Dunn does in his lab, that life would not exist without the ecosystem that we've created. So just think of the boundary of when does a building end and nature begin. It's totally blurred, but we try to treat it like these fine lines, and it's not that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Again, really, really deep. Listeners, you want to rewind that and put that back in your ears, but yeah, like this thing I'm talking to, or this thing that's me talking to you, like there's this Christoph talking to this Liz.
Yeah.
And we're trillions of living beings. Mm-hmm. And this thing I call my health is the dynamic kind of equilibrium seeking state of these trillions of living beings, right? Mm-hmm. And it was your book. I don't know where you referenced it, but 1 trillion of them live on our skin and 39 trillion total. Holy moly.
Yeah, right.
And then this idea of, you know, as a science person and you're a technology person, right? Like, I think it's reasonable to say, let's assume Liz is a separate being. Let me assume I'm a separate being. For lots of situations, that's a good model. Mm-hmm. But it's this idea, like, let's also remember that that's an assumption, that's a paradigm, that's a sociocultural construct, whatever you want to say. And it might not be true. It might be that in some areas, in some studies, you need to say, no, that's actually, let's remember that that was an assumption. Yeah.
And so much of how we understand ourselves as humans comes from scientific research and medical literature and that sort of thing. So the microbiome project came out so recently, what are we going to think of ourselves 100 years from now? I don't think it's going to be this isolationist mindset. It can't be.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Who was it? Jeremy Rifkin. I don't remember the title of the book right now offhand, but he had a book that basically future generations, we think linearly. And we have this sort of Cartesian thing. If I want to understand something, I need to take it apart into constituent elements. But future generations are going to recognize that as a deep distortion that was necessary for that phase of our intellectual development. But we need to think in ecosystems. So yeah. Ecosystem consciousness, even, so what you're just saying, just tantamount to saying, Christoph, you're an ecosystem.
Yeah.
Living in an ecosystem, within mm-hmm. another ecosystem. And somewhere there's the planetary systems. Wild. Okay, so we veered a little bit away from air quality again. So then there's particulates. So you mentioned this, the cooking. And then what else? Things that we do. Oh, our personal care products, scented mm-hmm. lotions and soaps. And I read that anything that says creamy or silky is probably got a plasticizer in it. These bisphenols. Okay. Yeah. So kind of watch for those. So that's us. That's one of the sources is humans and human activity, right? So things coming off of us and cleaning and cooking and I guess smoking, but that's not done so much anymore. I mean, some people do, but it's not good to smoke indoors in case you had any wonder.
We know. Yeah. I assume your listeners know that at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Personal care products. And then there's the buildings and themselves, which we're going to talk about sort of the main things here. And you mentioned latex paint earlier. You mentioned painting, the smell from mm-hmm. paint, right? So if I said latex gloves, everyone would say, oh, plastic gloves. If I say latex paint, it just TV snow test pattern comes on. Right. We don't think anything. But we basically down select microbes on indoor surfaces substantially via, what microbes can grow on plastic at temperatures and humidities that we like. Let's go back to sources. So there's us and then there's outdoor sources. Let's talk about those. I was going to talk about building materials.
Well, because so many people assume that indoor air quality is dependent on where you are in the city, if you're by a highway, if you're by a park, those sorts of things, which has a certain extent true. But this year-long study that I just did in these four different office buildings, what we found in these conditions was that it was overwhelmingly air quality was dependent on what was happening inside, largely relating to human activity, as opposed to outdoor air. And we had this unique condition where we were able to study one of the office buildings for 2 months without any ventilation air provided, because their DOAS system failed. So
how did you convince them?
I definitely did not. And I didn't know about it until 6 months later, because I knew they were doing construction. I didn't know what was going on. I kept sending them messages. I was like, guys, their CO2 was way over 2,000 parts per million every day. It was just, I can't even include that period of time on my graphs because I had to include a whole nother page. But what happened was it was in Atlanta, the system froze, so it closed the damper so that it wouldn't freeze the coils. The building engineer had never worked on a radiant system with a dedicated outdoor air system, so he didn't know that you needed to check that damper. So it remained closed until it got to be about March and they had an 80 degree day and it got stuffy in there. So we had a really unique opportunity to understand particulate matter. That's something that's tracked both indoor and outdoor, whereas VOCs, carbon dioxide, not so much. But we were able to see how well the MERV 13 filters worked. When the system was running properly, there was virtually no particulate matter inside. I mean, it closely tracked the outside levels. Mm-hmm. When the system was closed, there was no particulate matter. It didn't track it at all. And so there was no contamination from outdoors. Basically, everything was coming from inside. So it's that, again, that misconception is like, depends how close you are to the street or cars or that sort of thing. But it's, we're larger sources than the pollutants we typically associate with air contamination.
Mm-hmm. I love it. And well, I don't love it, but it is what it is. So you mentioned 2000 parts per million CO2. Could you put that in context of outdoor CO2 and happy CO2 levels indoors?
So I don't know, what's our level today, like 418 or 425, something around there, parts per million. That doesn't change much throughout the city, or I actually use the atmospheric level from the lab in Hawaii. It's not a huge amount of discrepancy. That's outdoor air. Indoor air, ASHRAE says anything below 1,000 parts per million, they say you're not going to smell your neighbor, basically. That's where that 1,000 parts per million come from. That's, I think, 5 CFM per person, to put it into ventilation terms. Joe Allen at Harvard Chan School of Public Health, what his study is finding, that anything above 550, you're going to start getting some sort of cognitive impairment. You start to feel sleepy. You perform less well on tests and that sort of thing. So if you have enhanced ventilation, he calls it 40 CFM per person, as opposed to the ASHRAE recommended 15, you're actually going to improve productivity by a certain amount, which that becomes something you can quantify. Because if you think of, like, in office buildings, what's the greatest expense of a company? It's the people. So if you improve the productivity of the people, you're going to get more return for making these investments.
That's huge.
But building code has not caught up yet. Building code is still saying 1,000 is fine, but evidence is showing it's fine, but you will be impaired to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's complicated too, because as someone who designs ventilation systems for homes and then lives in homes, I have a pretty good ventilation system in my house. And when it's just my wife and I and my daughter and our three dogs, you know, actually that's several hundred pounds of mammal breathing.
A lot of breathing.
We go up definitely 500, sometimes above. But when I have friends over and we have a party, you know, yeah, we'll hit 2000. I also know I have a Honda Fit, and my daughter had two friends in the back seat. My wife in the front seat. We were at 5,000 parts per million of CO2 in a little, like, whoa. But what I'm saying is it goes both ways, because asking architects to make the lungs of the building bigger, it's a big ask, right?
Yeah.
Culturally speaking, or in terms of cultural norms.
Well, it's also a huge energy load. You know, if you're ventilating air you've already conditioned, that's inefficient. So you have to balance those things.
Yeah. And that's where ERVs and HRVs, I mean, they're sort of these unsung heroes. People don't quite understand how phenomenally efficient new ERVs can be.
Someone else you should talk to, Selman Craig.
He does
a lot of work, or he did back when he was one of my professors when I was in grad school at MIT. He was teaching at Harvard.
Oh, really?
He had this breathing wall system, and the idea was that if you have these very small holes in the wall, and any sort of wall, you have a degree of friction on the outside of the wall, laminar flow, which adds to the R value. You know, we add that when we're calculating our R value.
Mm-hmm.
But if you calibrate those two streams of laminar flow in the opening, you can exchange heat there. So you can pass air through while exchanging heat. You're not using machines, you're not using electricity, you're just using the natural friction that comes with air movement. So it's these very simple passive approaches to, you know, if everybody was to understand heat exchange and just how that works at a physical level, then I think we wouldn't necessarily need all of these fancy expensive machines. Is that you can do a lot of that with just air friction.
That is tremendous. And I absolutely take you up on that. In fact, one of his grad students that worked on the breathing walls, I believe, Livia Barrett, is a friend of mine, and she's off.
Oh, okay.
She said, you got to meet this guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that, and I don't like that, right? You know, I like specking ERVs. I know ducts and keep airflows in the right zone, but, you know, this is where I actually have to take my own medicine and say, hey, are you humble enough to think that better means you follow it wherever it goes? Or do you stop and say, I actually am personally invested in that idea being correct. Otherwise, I'd have to absorb a large amount of regret for having trafficked in. But there, I also do know, like, I love this concept of the idea of simplicity on the other side of complexity, right? And the other side of an ERV enthalpy core being in this one little box is it's just your building. Yeah. It's doing energy recovery ventilation. Okay, so we covered a lot on sources. There's also, of course, the building materials. I think that's pretty well known. And then there's the inside of the duct systems, which is another building surface, which we don't talk about. So just to summarize on pollutant sources, it's us and our activities. It's building materials, which includes furnishings, fabrics, you know, the finishes we choose to put around us, like the latex paint. It's building surfaces, building systems, and then outdoor sources. So we covered all those. So moving on from pollutants to pathways. Specifically, we're talking about pathways of these things that are carried in the air to us. Any thoughts on that?
You know, we were talking about the breathing walls and building facades and building tightness and that sort of thing. The human body is very permeable. We emit things through our skin. We emit things, obviously, through our mouth and our nose and that sort of thing. Buildings are really designed. They're very tight. They're meant to keep the machines happy and enclosed. But I think that the building needs to operate a bit more like the body, like an ecosystem, understanding that there are flows that we're responding to on both sides of that enclosure. And the challenging thing with this conversation and a lot of my work is about blurred edges and blurring the boundaries between inside and out is that makes people very uncomfortable because you cannot use conventional mechanical systems to do that type of work. You're using heat exchangers as part of the wall or using laminar flow to do different types of things. So I don't have a nostalgic view of like going back to natural ventilation and that sort of thing. We have really advanced technologies.
It sounded like you did.
And no, because natural ventilation is great, but we can do so much if you integrate a system and if, you know, I'm not an AI person, but if you were to do things that like would track how air moved and you could have a more dynamic enclosure, that's like passive house of the future. You know, you want to be as low energy and as passive as possible, but if you use just a little bit of energy to do really powerful things through breathing and through respiration, whether it's the building or the human, you know, we're talking about pathways and that sort of thing. Humans emit so much just by being human, the bacteria that's on our skin, the smells in our clothing, that sort of thing. So it's not like air is coming in through filters and it's creating these things. It's just like, if I were to go on my walking desk and I would emit more carbon dioxide, that sort of thing. So my behavior is going to change. The pathway is going to change just based on behavior.
So I love this idea of blurred edges. And frankly, I think that's really what we've been talking about here. The paradigms make blurred edges. And this thing that I am several trillion living beings is a blurred edge. But now, getting into the indoor air quality in terms of pathways, right? We think to ourselves, what we need is like a very non-blurred, a very stark line. This is inside, that's outside. And in fact, that is absolutely currently the paradigm. Right?
Yeah.
Building science, mm-hmm. right? The air barrier, it's a red line, a bright red line. You could draw it on your architectural section. You should, and it's a good idea. I'm building a passive house. And I actually, you didn't change my mind, but the blurring is interesting. The blurring is, I'm building a passive house with a fantastic air control layer and thermal control layer for when it's way hot or way cold or way more polluted outside and I don't want a blurred edge.
Yeah.
If I build in a way that the edge is permanently blurred, well, that's also not good. But what's interesting, and it's actually a question I'm going to ask you and a question I don't have the answer to, but like I'm going to have a really good air control layer and I'm going to have an ERV. Is the ERV bringing in outdoor air? Is that a blurred edge now? Is that like an open window? Technologically mediated?
It's funny. It's kind of like it's a modernist window. And, you know, some of the films that I reference in the movie, it's like, why would you have windows? It's like, well, we didn't have machines to provide air and light. And so now that we have machines that do all that work, we don't need the joy of looking outdoors, hearing the birds chirp, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Wow. That's real. It seems very techno future. But, you know, I have wondered, like, why don't I just do a really high def wall TV screen essentially on my wall, and then I could have whatever view I want. I want to see big square.
Oh gosh, you're breaking my heart.
I'm joking too, but it's like, that's where you led me. Tell me about breaking your heart there.
Well, and I bring this up with Sarah because the microbial exposure,
right,
of actually having outdoor exposure, mm-hmm, makes you healthier, makes you happier. It is, you know, scientifically proven. And that when we're constantly reducing all of this exposure and we only have human systems inside the building, we're losing a lot of that, you know, kind of, mm-hmm, joy, microbial joy that we get from outside. And having a dog, actually, this is, I got to include a photo of my dirty dog in the book.
Yeah, I love that. I'm in a room with two big dogs right now. Yeah.
But just having a dog and the microbes that come in on their paws is good for children because it exposes them to more things.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, in fact, I was being facetious in some sense because there's this ocular centrism in the industry, right? It's like looking around the room and looking out the windows, right? So this windows are thought of as connections to nature. And I agree with you wholeheartedly that what the biological aspect of my body, not the psychological, but it wants the connection to nature to be the massive outdoor air that includes the microbes, right? And that I know of, even an ERV, you know, enthalpy exchanger core, is down selecting for certain microbial transfers across that. I mean, I'm sure some of them are, but some of them aren't. And an open window, right? So up here in Pacific Northwest, the window will be open unless it's bitter cold, bitter hot, or crazy hot, or wildfire, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, I think it's fair to say that we don't know what the right microbial mix is for humans. We can't make a synthetic probiotic for every human, that sort of thing, because the science has not evolved yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I was at a seminar and I didn't record it. It was in Houston. This is early, like the early 2000s or something. What she said was that the Western medical view is that the human microbiome functions as a master regulatory organ in our body, mm-hmm, and that Western science currently knows very little about it. And what we do know, or think we know, I think that's an important addition, is that what we like, what our bodies like, is diversity, as you just said.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we've come to the end of this part, but I want to wrap up with a surprise ending for you.
Uh-oh.
And it's actually putting you on the spot, but only briefly. So we have Liz McCormick here, and we've mentioned Sarah Haynes. Z. Smith has been on the podcast, but you also have Marcel Harmon and Ulysses Vance. But what I wanted to do briefly was go to the table of contents and just introduce their chapters. So the book, kind of summarizing the book, hey, listeners, right, this book is for everybody. This is written in very accessible terms. You don't have to be a nerd. Maybe the nerd helped me like get my way through it rapidly and underline a lot of stuff. But so Liz wrote an introduction and a chapter, two other chapters, one, air quality and human health, which we've touched on. And then this socially constructed microbiome, which is fantastic. And then, so Liz, just a few words about chapter 3, The Microscopic World of Building Science, and Sarah Haynes. Yeah.
So working with Sarah was really fun because she wrote a draft of this chapter. And I was like, Sarah, you are talking to architects and like normal humans. You are not talking to biologists. And so she toned it way down.
Oh, interesting.
So that we could understand it. But it's, you know, the idea that we're not alone in these environments. We're not individuals. There are all of these communities around us. And, you know, she even talked about like our microbial footprints, where this can be used in forensic science, where you can tell based on not even DNA, but just the microbes that are left in a space, who they came from.
Wow, fascinating. I look forward to getting her on here. Thank you in advance for introduction. She's at the university for the introduction. She's at the University of Toronto. Yeah. And then chapter four is called, and this one was a heady one. I thought I had to really stop and go, whoa, yeah. I get it. It's called The Building Occupant. Well, I should say it this way. It's The Building / Occupant Organism. Marcel Harmon. Any thoughts?
Yeah. Marcel is a anthropologist who went back to school for training as an engineer, and he now works at a, you know, green building consulting an engineering company, Branch Pattern. And his chapter is basically understanding our evolutionary history, and is specifically related to ionization technologies. And yes, it can and clean the air and have all these amazing effects, but what does that mean for our evolutionary pathway? And how are we, again, part of a community, part of a, you know, our legacy of humanity, and these things that we're putting in our buildings, what is that doing to our evolutionary pathway?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I'd actually love to meet him too. And someone just said, you should meet this guy from Branch Pattern in an email.
It's gotta be him. He's great.
And so, but you alluded on the back into like a podcast a little bit. You alluded to this earlier about how one of the unique things about being humans is we make choices on how our evolutionary pathway is going to go while not being aware that we're making such a momentous choice. Yikes. Yeah. Okay. So then chapter five, Z Smith.
I'm sure everybody who listens to your podcast probably is interfaced with Z in some way. Z has been my mentor for a number of years, and I talked to him just last week. I had this idea, and he always has this mentality of like, who are the kids in your sandbox? Who are the ones you talk to and have ideas with? And he's definitely someone who's in my sandbox. But his chapter is very much about the metrics and how we need to understand the metrics to make informed building design decisions.
And so he sure does, and all the folks at EDR. Mm-hmm. And chapter six, this is a good one too. Respiratory Equity, Ulysses Sean Vance.
Yeah, so he goes by Sean Vance. He's at Temple University. He's a practicing architect / academic, probably more academic than architect practicing at this point. But he does a lot of work with healthcare design and actually bringing healthcare into communities and that sort of thing. So he's less about the building and the enclosure, I think, less than the rest of us who are in this book. But very much just focus on access to clean air and how it's a human right and something that we all should strive for. And that connecting to Z's chapter, understanding the metrics and making sure that it's accessible to all. I was going to say all who need it, but we all need it. So it's accessible to everybody.
Mm-hmm. That's tremendous. When we talked early about resources like a Costco being available for human end uses, like the resources we're consuming are clean air, clean water, and arable soil. Like those are the big ones.
Yeah.
And we don't realize it. Okay. And then we have chapter seven is a transcript of your discussion that you mentioned at that brewery. That was tremendous.
Yeah.
You write the final chapter, Reconciling Inside and Out. Any thoughts on that to end with?
You know, the thing I always get nervous about with these types of conversations is like, all right, so what's the proposal? What are you going to do? And because my work is so much about contextualizing decisions we've already made, not necessarily making proposals for the future, but, you know, understanding the world we live within so that we can start adapting those decisions. And so what that chapter is about something that Z and I worked on together at a facade competition called the Ecotone, where instead of having these hard lines in ecological conditions, an ecotone is a mixing of ecological zones. And it's also where you have the greatest species diversity. It's kind of just where the planet is the happiest at these little mixing zones. And so how can we treat a building facade instead of like a line, but actually more like a gradient? So this was a quick little competition that we did that we ended up winning a number of years ago, just showing how a facade can be a spatial environment and using that potentially as a jumping off point.
Love it. Love it. I was actually thinking about hot outside or cold outside, hot and warm inside. There is a gradient in that wall.
Yep.
So we don't think that. We don't seem to think about that. We call that a bright line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tremendous. And thank you for taking the time to do this book, collect these essays. I know it was a labor of love and a huge investment of effort. And thank you. And
you know, it's funny, when I got the print copy, I was like, this tiny little thing, this is my book. This is like 5 years of my life working on this tiny thing. I thought it was going to be this, like, you drop it on a table and it makes it boom, right. But it doesn't.
It is big impact though. Honestly, readers, I wholeheartedly recommend this book, and I'm not like, there's no sponsorship here. You know me. If you know me, leaders, you know that this is the type of book that you'll probably be interested in. And that I definitely am. So Liz, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you. This is fun.
And thank you all for listening too. We'll talk to you next time.
Yeah.